The House Transportation Committee will come to order. Welcome. And we have a couple of bills today. The first one is one of my favorites, but we'll get to hear. And that's, I'll go ahead and open the public hearing on House Bill 2396. Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2396 authorizes the issuance of lottery bonds to finance an extension of the bus rapid transit system in West Eugene. It creates a West Eugene EMX extension fund and continuously appropriates monies that are in the fund to the Economic and Community Development Department for use in the financing of costs incurred by the Lane Transit District for establishing the West Eugene EMX extension. This bill has an emergency clause and would take effect on July 1st of this year. You also have in your packets some amendments that were submitted, the Dash 1 amendment that that I'm sure one of our people who are going to be testifying will speak to.
Thank you. And with that, are we going to go ahead and split them? Or?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead and call up Representative Paul Holvey, Mayor Kitty Piercy, and Mark Pangborn. And I know we have another member in the audience, but he'll... Yeah, he'll set them up with the next panel. We'll split them up.
Yes.
Green. Green.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And committee members. My name is Paul Holvey, State Representative from District 8, which takes in a good portion of South and West Eugene and South Central Lane County. I appreciate the opportunity to testify to you today on House Bill 2396. You may know already, this bill is looking to lottery bonds to help fund West Eugene EMX Bus Rapid Transit Project. It's an extension of an existing transit project in the Eugene-Springfield area that has done a great job of helping to control congestion and provide alternative transportation to a lot of people in our area. We're looking at the ability for $30 million in bonds overall, but as you see, the Dash 1 amendments provide that in increments, starting out with $1.6 million in 2009-11. And then going up to 8.4 in the 11-13, and then 20 million and 13-15. This project, of course, is central not just to transportation, but also a great economic driver for our area, not just in getting workers the ability to commute, but in the construction projects that will come from this in a time when our economy could really use some more jobs. We already have commitments from the federal government for funds on this, and the state and the lottery-backed bonds would provide some matching dollars to ensure that this project gets done. I'm pretty excited about this project because it does serve part of my district and part of Representative Edwards' district as well. It is a vital link of our transportation system. It's estimated we'll have at least 1,500 jobs out of this project. So no time better than right now, I think, to get something like this on board for our area and for the state. So I appreciate your support with this bill and moving it down to Ways and Means with a favorable recommendation. Thank you very much, and I'll turn it over to my colleagues to the right.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. Thank you so much for allowing us to speak to you today. I'm Kitty Piercy, the mayor of Eugene, Oregon. Increased usage of our driving traffic congestion in the West 11th corridor, and this leads to longer transit travel times, increased cost of operation, and deteriorating transit reliability. Bus rapid transit has been designed to address these issues, and the regional transportation plan calls for a bus rapid transit strategy for the region. West Eugene has been prioritized by the Eugene City Council and the LTD Board of Directors as a third MX line to pursue. The West Eugene MX will support regional local and state goals for transportation and land use. It also aligns really very, very well with the City of Eugene's sustainability policies, including efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. MX is actually, I just came back from D.C. yesterday, and where I heard from everybody about MX being known as a national model, with groups coming to see it from all over the United States and even other parts of the world, like Israel, the Philippines, and Brazil. When Eugene hosted the U.S. Olympic track and field trials in 2008, visitors from all over the country were able to use MX to get from local hotels to Hayward Field. One of the things that I always like to point out is not only does MX provide transportation services to our most vulnerable and needy folks, but it also is rapidly and successfully moving people like me out of our cars and onto MX. And I regularly take it from downtown either to the University of Oregon or on over to Springfield. And it is easier than trying to find a place to park your car. It's working just as it should work. We are eager to have the third route in Eugene. The faster we can get this whole system together, the better. We have a lot of planning processes that this can dovetail with, so it's very important to our community, and I strongly support extending MX to West Eugene. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'm Mark Pangborn. I'm the general manager of Lane Transit District. And reminding the council, you know that the LTD was created by state statute, and actually the board is appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. So we've been involved with the state for some time. We're excited about MX and what it's going to do. We believe from the results that we've had with our first line that it will be critical for the economic development of the West Eugene area in terms of creating jobs. It will also help us reduce our dependence on foreign oil and ultimately reduce greenhouse gases as well because of its efficiency. Our first line, we call it MX for Emerald Express, but it gets shortened to MX, sometimes spelled EMX. But our first line opened in 2007 and immediately was a success. The ridership exceeded the 20-year projections that the computer model said that we're going to have 40% increase. We had over 100% increase on the system. The great thing about that was it was 80% federal funded, and almost $19 million came in to help support that system. Our second line is now under construction. Again, the state was a strong participant. You put $5.4 million in Connect Oregon, one money into that, and that leveraged over $33 million in federal money to help us build this line. It's going to go out to the Gateway area, where it's probably one of the more vibrant growth areas in the community. We're here to ask for state support and lottery-backed bonding authority for $30 million for this third line that will go out into West Eugene. This is the first step in the process. The second step will be to pick the locally preferred alternative, which is a federal term for what the route will be for this third corridor. And if you look up on this map here, I guess on your left, we're talking about that area that's highlighted in red. And there are actually three options where the corridor might go through. But the federal process requires that you go through a very extensive community input process that finally results in both the Eugene City Council and the Lane Transit District Board picking a final preferred route for that alternative. With state support and the locally preferred alternative for the route, we are then in line, really first in line, for federal funding under the reauthorization of the Federal Surface Transportation Act. And as Mayor Piercy has pointed out, this project is really high on everybody's list, both Congressman DeFazio as well as Oberstar's and with the Federal Transit Administration. So we urge your support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Call.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I'd just like to tell you how great I think Lane Transit District is. You guys do a fantastic job. I've actually had the opportunity to ride down there a couple of times many years ago, and I'm glad to see that it's expanding. Just one quick question. Do you all levy a payroll tax locally currently?
Yes, we do. There are two systems in the state, TriMet and LTD, and we both levy a payroll tax.
So just a comment, Madam Chair. It's safe to say that you guys are doing everything you can locally to raise these transit funds, and that you're leveraging as aggressively as you can right now the federal dollars, and that this is going to simply add to that and allow you to pull down more federal dollars.
Yes.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Oh, Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to echo Representative Call's comments. I had the opportunity to ride the MX last summer and thought it was a wonderful experience. The bus ride, by the way, for those committee members who haven't had the opportunity, is actually similar to riding the MAX without the with the added advantage of being able to get on and off the bus more rapidly. And it's a very comfortable ride. And I thought it was very it does a better job of utilizing existing assets as opposed to creating new rights of way. It was and I actually proposed a similar type of system in my district to TriMet to see if they would explore that concept using some of the existing existing rights of way in a new fashion. And I appreciate the innovative nature of the program.
I could just add a comment to that, Chairman Beyer. For those of you who haven't been on it, I think the really interesting experience is when you're on it, you do feel like you're on a light rail kind of system. It opens, it has a unique situation and doors opening on both sides. You get off at street level, so it just feels very much like a different quality of experience for folks who are riding. So I appreciate your comments very much.
Yeah. I do have a question. I was wondering if you've explored the possibility of receiving any additional federal stimulus dollars for this project. I know that there are some dollars allocated for that purpose. I don't know if this project is eligible.
It is, and in fact, the final funding piece for the second line, the one that's under construction now, there's a $3 million funding piece, and the Federal Transit Administration is trying to decide whether to use stimulus dollars for that or use another source of funds. The line we're talking about here is far enough out into the future that we wouldn't be able to be, even clearly, we haven't picked the alternative yet, so we wouldn't be shovel ready.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, thank you for coming
you.
Today. I think a good portion of these people have been in Washington, D.C. and just got back yesterday. So.
Right.
Looking for stimulus experience.
Representative Chris Edwards, if you want to come up, and Rob Zako and Jared Mason Gear. Edward, I'll extend the courtesy for you to go first, unless you'd rather wrap up. Okay.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'm Jared Mason. For the record, Jared Mason Gear with the Eugene Area Chamber of Commerce. Thank you for having me. The Eugene Area Chamber of Commerce, as well as our counterparts at the Springfield Chamber of Commerce, are very supportive of this project. Transportation in the western part of Eugene has been a sticking point for quite some time. Those of you who are familiar with the area may know that, and the chamber has been very involved and very concerned with trying to solve some of those issues for quite some time. We see this as a potential fix to some of the serious congestion problems we're seeing in that part of Eugene. We also see this as a very strong economic driver as far as providing transportation to the existing businesses there, as well as potentially providing some notice to potential incoming businesses that we will be taking steps to address the transportation problems out there. Also very excited about the potential impacts of the construction on this project, the multiplier effects from the spending that would be generated through the construction workers. Although we're aware that this won't be happening until 2013, there are a number of organizations in the greater Eugene area that are taking significant steps to prepare ourselves to capitalize on and take advantage of the rebound that we expect will happen sometime in the very near future. And we think this is a big piece of preparing ourselves for that. I'm happy to answer any questions, although I'm certainly not the expert on this project that some of the other folks here are. Thanks again for letting me be here.
Thank you. Okay, Rob?
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. I'm Rob Zake, and I'm a resident of Eugene. I'm a former transportation advocate for 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I'm currently a member of the Transportation Growth Management Advisory Committee, and I'm a member of the West Eugene Collaborative, which just released a report today. I'm testifying in support of House Bill 2396. I read in the Washington Post just a few days ago that transit ridership across America is at the highest level since the 1950s when the interstate system was first started. And it's been rising with rising gas prices. It's been rising with falling gas prices. There's a demand for transit. Improving transit service reduces our dependence on foreign oil, reduces traffic congestion, the need to invest in expensive highways, helps people get to work or to school for retraining, for example, and reduces our reliance on greenhouse gas emissions. Here in Oregon, for a long time, we've been leading the way on good transportation planning. Statewide Transportation Planning Goal 12 calls for a safe, convenient economic transportation system. In particular, it calls for reducing reliance on the automobile, for meeting the demands of the transportation disadvantaged, and for conserving energy. And investing in MX will do all these things and more. Also here in Oregon, as you know, last session, House Bill 3543 set fairly aggressive targets for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, looking out to the year 2050. Again, investing in transit, investing in MX is a way to achieve those goals. Finally, as I said, the West Eugene Collaborative, which is a group of business leaders, environmentalists, neighborhood leaders, elected officials, have been studying the larger set of problems in West Eugene and what to do about traffic problems there. We just released a report earlier today, and we see the need for improved transit in West Eugene. We see MX as an essential part of that, getting people to work from where they live to where they shop. So I support the bill. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Edwards. I'm state representative in West Eugene, Santa Clara, and Junction City, House District 14. I'm here very much in support of this project and the funding for this project. It should be noted at the outset, as Representative Holvey said, that this project goes very much along the edge and through my district, and it serves the area of Eugene that is really is the growth area of Eugene, and so there is a significant economic development component and aspect to this project, and so it's quite important for my district. It meets the goals for the use of lottery bonds. It creates construction jobs and promotes long-term job growth by improving the commute for employees who work there now and who will work there in the future on those large undeveloped parcels of land. In 2007, the legislature approved gave TriMet authorization for $250 million in lottery-backed bonds for the Southeast Metropolitan Extension Project. And it should be noted fairly that we're about one-tenth, LTD's size is about one-tenth the size of TriMet, and perhaps there's about one-tenth as many as legislators supporting this project, and we're asking for about one-tenth as much money. So I think this is an equitable project, And I really encourage your support. This project is too big, albeit one-tenth the size of the TriMet project. It is too big for LTD to fund alone, and it's perhaps too big to be thrown into a competitive pool like Connect Oregon 3. In the Eugene Springfield area, we're building a transportation system that is forward-looking and is really going to give attract those who are not just transit-dependent because of the frequency with which these lines run, and it's also an opportunity to build a more a green transportation option. So for those of you that like this project because it's economic development, this is a good one. For those of you that are looking for another green vote, this is a good one. So I'm looking at you.
Absolutely.
So thank you very
green
much.
Votes.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Schaffler?
That's exactly what I was going to say, Representative. There were some things that passed last session. I didn't vote for all of them, but, you know, if we want to get carbon emissions out of the air, which I think we all do, this is the way to do it. When I went to college, I lived in a suburb of Iowa City, and I rode the bus or my bicycle every day and saved me a lot of money. And the students that don't have any money need this kind of transportation, and it also provide them with more housing options and employment options. But more importantly, and you touched on it, Representative, light rail is going to go, it isn't in my district, but actually it will cut through just a peninsula of my district on the west side and give opportunity to my constituents to ride the light rail all the way down to Portland State or wherever they need to go. And we have spent a lot of money up there in that area, and I think it's only right and fair that we spend some money down in your area. And it's going to create a bunch of jobs out of the gate, and all the other great things that come along with it. So it's a great bill, and Madam Chair, I hope we're going to work it and move it out of here, and I think it's a good, wise use of money.
Well, I'm hoping to work it too, but not today.
Yes, ma'am.
And I have a feeling that maybe there might be an amendment needed for this bill before we can move it. But any other questions? I don't see any, but I do want to thank you all for coming. I think my community has been blessed with being the benefit of the first two phases of the EMX, and it really is a great opportunity for my committee. And I'm not going to go into it, but Representative Schaffler, there's also opportunities to cut trees, too.
Hallelujah.
Madam Chair, I think we're going to use it.
I will not elaborate, but remember.
my good friend here reminded me we're probably going to be using a lot of gravel on this project.
Yeah.
The gravel is coming from China, Representative Schaffler.
Representative Widener.
I'm good.
Okay. You got your comment in? Thank you. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
And not seeing anybody else, I really appreciate your coming, and we'll be in touch on where we go from here. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2396, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2884. Yes, Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2884 allows Waymasters and Motor Carrier Enforcement Officers to use warning lights or other signals for the purposes of stopping commercial motor vehicle operators. It requires the Department of Transportation to provide training and education for Waymasters and Motor Carrier Enforcement Officers on how to safely stop and detain vehicles. And it directs the Department to report to the 77th Legislative Assembly on effectiveness of the program and sunsets authority on January 2nd, 2014. If I'm not mistaken, Madam Chair, I think the 77th is not the next legislature, but the one after that, right?
More, yeah.
Carry the two, yeah.
Okay, with that, Representative Call.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Nick Call, State Representative from House District 49. My comments will be brief today because I'm sure there's going to be ample testimony on both sides of this bill. And I just wanted to share with you my thoughts on this. When I first decided to work on this bill, I was told this is a very contentious issue. It turns out that it kind of is. But the reason I care about this bill is from my first days in office, and I've not been here that long. I'm relatively new, which might be why I'm willing to take on a contentious bill. Maybe I'm being a bit foolhardy. But from my first days, we were talking about readjusting our budgets. From our first days, there have been a sense of low morale amongst workers in state government, that there's great concern amongst them. And from my first days, I had a group of employees in my office who weren't complaining about the budget or about their salaries or about anything that we were doing to them. They were complaining because we weren't allowing them to do the job that they wanted to do. We have a group of committed state employees who want to make our roads safer, who up until 4 years ago were making our roads safer to their way of seeing things and had done that job for decades without incident. I think that during these times when there was so much tumult, so much turmoil, so much troubles, and so much difficulty in the issues that we're dealing with, I was looking for a way in which we could really work with our state employees to allow them to do the jobs that they want to do. And this really seemed like a way to do that for me, and boost the morale of some of our committed employees, some of our committed state employees who simply want to do their job. And that's why I support this bill. That's why I've brought it before you today. And with that, I'll take questions, but look forward to hearing testimony.
All right. Any questions for Representative? I guess they're going to let you rest. And
for that, I'm thankful.
Okay, and it looks like I have five people who signed up together. If we want to, I'll bring the first three up and then the next two, or is that going to work? Kermit? Mealing? I can't. No. Mailing. See, and I should know. Mike Cobb and Dennis Rucker?
Ruka.
And Madam Chair, I forgot one thing. I'm sorry.
Yes.
There's a letter that's been handed to you from Representative Barker expressing his support of this bill. He's at the dentist's office today, so he's supportive of it, and you all have a letter from him saying as such. Thank you.
Not where I want. As much as we love sitting here.
So we'll go ahead and let you start, Kermit.
Thank you, Chairman Byers and representatives of the committee. I appreciate you allowing us to come back before you again this session. What the young lady's handing out is a notebook that's more of a reference material than it is of anything. It's a history of some of the issues that have happened in the Motor Carrier Enforcement Office. It's not all good for us, and it's not all bad. It's just a history of all the DOJ's opinions, and I'll run through it real quick. One of the rumors I do want to dispel right off the bat is that for years they've always said that motor carrier enforcement officers wanted to be armed and in the police and firemen's pension fund, and we have no intention for that. We're not seeking anything like that, and I just wanted to make sure I cleared that up. Table 1 is the DOJ's opinion from 1988 that asked if our officers needed to be driving vehicles that were declared as emergency vehicles. And that DOJ's opinion stated that no, we did not, that we did have the authority to use the red lights at that time to stop the vehicles. That was tab 2, excuse me. Tab 3 is a risk assessment that was conducted back in 1997 that made it certain recommendations in training and what types of vehicles we had and training on how to handle hostile customers. Tab 4 is from our enforcement officer's manual from 2002, and it outlines what department guidelines were in effect at that time for us to use for traffic stops back in 2002. Tab 5 is the DOJ's opinion that resulted in the question regarding our activity on I-5 when we were requested by citizens' complaints to go up there and enforce trucks that were not using the bypass lane up the truck lane, basically on I-5 northbound. And we went up there and did it, and then there was a question asked, and in this it said that, no, that is not something we should not be doing, and that's the opinion on that. And then tab 6 is the DOJ's opinion that asked if we had about the authority to use our lights to stop vehicles, and that's basically why we're here. The opinion said that we should seek legislative clarity over the issue, and this is several times that we've been here and asked for this, and hopefully we'll get straightened out this time. And then some of the other things in that tab are just reference material. Tab 7 is the laws governing emergency vehicles, the ORSs, and the ones and what lights people use and such. Tab 8 is what training might look like from what we had before, where we had conflict, resolving conflict, verbal judo, which is a technique that's used both in industry and by police officers. There are two different classes, and we took the business course of it years ago. And it's how to defuse hostile people. It tells you how to basically how to divert their anger energy from you onto a third party or empathy or some way to calm them down. At one time, we actually went through skid car classes up in Portland, stopping procedures. What they say here is pursuit driving, but it's not high-speed pursuit. We don't do high-speed. We're not emergency vehicles. We cannot exceed the speed limit by department policy by more than 10 miles an hour. This was a training that was performed by the BPST years ago down at the Corvallis Airport, in which they actually just taught us how to handle the vehicles. You know, at 55 miles an hour, what's it going to do? And this is what you need to do. It was working cones, skid cars, and things of that nature. Public contact skills, how to contact people, do it in a manner that's not aggressive or threatening. And then finally, another class of handling difficult customers and trying to understand them and try to figure out ways to help them without escalating a thing. And when you know that situation's going south, just to back out of it and get away from the issue. Tab 9 is just a summary of what a work zone plan is that we're currently under. When we go out to do portables, we have to set up temporary work zones, which includes flags, and it has some diagrams in here and also some pictures that show some white spots that are old white spots that we've had throughout the state that we do use. And tab 10 is the Secretary of State's audit from 2002 that suggested that we were not doing enough back road enforcement. And I think Representative Schaffler would appreciate this. Since Sunnyside Road is now a four-lane highway, and when they added in above their scale, the trucks will be using Sunnyside Road to go around the scale instead of to the scale, and it's going to be a major impact on his area. Tab 11 is a follow-up audit that was done in 2004, and it was asking what things had been implemented and what hadn't, and the Motor Carrier Transportation Branch's response to those. Tab 12 shows you exactly what most of our vehicles look like this time. We have a mixed bag. These are white ones. They're equipped with light bars, four-way strobe lights in the corners. They actually have a traffic advisory stick in the back, which we can direct traffic either left and right, or we can make them flash on the vans and in the rear windows of the sedans. And the last picture in that shows what the current vehicles look like. They're yellow. They have one little red light up on them and no other markings. And tab 13 shows what a construction inspector vehicle looks like, and it looks an awful lot like ours. The only difference is that their little light up on top is yellow and ours is red. and it's pretty hard to tell the difference between the two of them, which makes it very hard for us to do our job. Tab 14 is just some incidents and things that we run across. That big beam that dropped off on the front when there was on I-205 and the dolly came loose and they dropped that bridge beam right on the freeway. It didn't do the pavement much good, but it did tie up traffic for quite a while. The heavy haul on the next page, I actually stopped that vehicle myself. They had a guy in a pickup running what's known as the front door to see if the scale was open, and unfortunately I was coming back from the scale and I happened to catch him before he got on the freeway, which resulted in them offloading the roller because they couldn't have two pieces of heavy equipment on this trailer in the configuration that it was in because it was way overweight. And tab 15 is just a summary of it. And to summarize this pretty much, is that if we're not enforcing the size and weight out on the back roads, about 20% to 30% of the trucks will be running around heavy. We found that out recently out in North Plains in Washington County. One of the back routes was closed off. We usually get about 100 trucks a day on an 8-hour shift out there through the scale and about a 2% citation rate. The rate went up to over 200 trucks a day, and our citation rate tripled because all the trucks that were usually going around the scale couldn't do it anymore because they had to come to the scale because it was the only road they had. So, and there's a... The people that put in our green light system, International Road Dynamics, at a conference, it's the multi-state highway transportation agreement, which Oregon's a part of, stated that they did a study in Idaho that showed that trucks will drive 160 miles out of their way to avoid a scale if they know that they're overweight and stuff. And having grown up in the construction and trucking background before I came to work for the state, I can testify that that's quite true. I myself have figured out ways to go around scales quite often when I was in the business. And knowing the culture, when citations get expensive, you will go around them. And that's pretty much all I have. Oh, one other thing. At the end of last session, we thought we had a pilot program in place, and it was agreed to by all the parties, both industry and us, our union members and of the officers, and somehow it slipped through the cracks, and that's why we had to end up coming back here for clarification. Thank you, Chairman Byers.
Thank you. Committee, shall we finish the panel, and then if you have questions. Thank you. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. Representatives.
Pull one of the microphones over towards you and identify yourself.
Yes, my name is Michael Cobb. I'm a motor carrier enforcement officer out of the Ashland District. Just a little background on myself. Prior to going to work for motor carrier enforcement about 5.5 years ago, I spent 23 years in law enforcement in Southern California. One of the jobs I did was for 8 years, I was a traffic safety education officer for our department. So I know a little bit about traffic safety, and I'm here today to talk about the safety issues that have been expressed both through industry and through representatives and through motor carrier about our safety out on the highway. One of the issues that came up last time when we were before this committee was that people seemed to be concerned about our safety out on the highway. Let me just assure you that as motor carrier enforcement officers, we're all concerned about our safety out on the highway. We're, you know, required to work in close proximity to large trucks. So there is an inherent danger in our job that we can't avoid. We can do everything we can to try to minimize those dangers. But there is that inherent danger, and it's just part of the job. One of the things that's been discussed here is you know, the safety in us stopping vehicles on the highway. Okay? Unlike police officers who stop all manner of vehicles on the highway and have no idea who they're coming in contact with, we deal with one facet of the motoring public, and that's commercial enforcement or commercial truck drivers. By and large, 99.9% of those people are just out earning a living, doing what they do. And, you know, it's part of our job to make sure that they do it as safely and legally as possible. So when I hear them talking about the hazards of stopping a vehicle on the highway, one thing that I'm looking at is, in contacting his driver, are we facing a higher hazard than if we're stopping this individual at a remote scale, all by ourselves, in the middle of the night? Is there any more danger doing that than pulling that truck over on the highway? So you have to ask yourself, is there? And it's my opinion that there is not. And the reason I'm saying that is, when we make contact with a person out at a scale, we're in close proximity to traffic on the highway. Except the port of entries, who have jersey barriers and all that stuff. When you go out to a site where we just have a car or a little scale shack, generally those scale shacks are within 50, 60 feet of the highway. Which, you know, when you put a truck in there and another lane, there's not much barrier between you and the motoring public. Same thing with a traffic stop. Except in the traffic stop, you can approach on the passenger side of that vehicle and put an 80,000-pound truck between you and the motoring public. So you have to think of that as, is it safer to do what we do at a portable site, or is it safer to stop a truck on the highway? I would lean towards it's kind of safer to stop a truck on the highway because I don't have to put myself on the roadside of that vehicle to make contact with the driver where we do in a portable situation. Another thing that's been brought up in the past is the authority that we have, and you're probably going to hear a lot about that. That's why we're here, is to ask you to give us that authority back. We have very limited authority when it comes to stopping vehicles on the highway. By our own policy that's still in our manual, and I'm looking at Section 9, part of our enforcement manual, dated 11-14-05, some of the things that we have to consider are traffic density, weather conditions, road conditions, time of day, intersection hazards, and all other hazards. I mean, this stuff is already written into our policy regarding stopping trucks, et cetera, or even following trucks, as this is talking about. There's other things that road surface width, hazards at intersections, weather, visibility, so on and so forth. These are things that I'm quoting right out of our enforcement manual that are there now. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that we don't have to reinvent the wheel to get this authority back. And the large majority of motor carrier enforcement officers that are working out there were working out there in 2004 when we had our authority removed. So training is not a huge issue and can really be conducted in-house when you have some training for trainers. Send them to OSP to get some updated training and then have those people train the balance of your motor carrier enforcement officers. And that's all I have to say on the subject. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dennis Ruka. I'm the senior officer at the Woodburn District, motor carrier enforcement officer. Sorry about that. I get the opportunity to talk about something near and dear to our hearts, money. You're going to get cost estimates on what it would cost to get our authority clarified. I don't say get our authority back. I believe we always had it. We're asking for clarification now. When it comes to the equipment, initially we keep a vehicle 8 to 10 years. So the initial outlay, of course, is putting the lights on so the public can be safe around us and we can safely pull a truck over. The majority of our vehicles now still have that light package. So the initial cost outlay to get the vehicles back doing that job, it will be negligible. The personnel that were trained 4 years ago, 5 years ago, in the pursuit training, they called it pursuit training then. We don't like to call it pursuit training. I like to say following them, and with our red lights on, and the truck by law pulls over and stops, and we just pull over and go talk to him. Those people are still there, so they're already trained. So the initial cost of this to get going again would, like I said, be negligible. We already have the vehicles. We already have the people. The people that aren't trained, they're not allowed to do it.
It's simple. It's a training issue. So when it comes to vehicles, we have those. The training, we have that. I don't think you're going to see an initial cost outlay of hardly anything. When we do rotate vehicles out, we pull the lights off and move them to the new vehicle. So we don't have to buy them again, unless the lights get so old that they're antiquated. The cost there would be getting them professionally installed instead of doing it ourselves. Most of us don't have that ability. And then again, they last 8 to 10 years. So as we rotate the vehicles through, you're going to have that initial cost. But again, over the 8 to 10-year life expectancy, it's negligible. And I think that interests people a lot more than what we do with trucks. I think a lot of people would like us to pull trucks over, but they don't want to put a whole lot of money out there for us to do it. And I sent a note out with you. I did hear a rumor that there were very few motor carrier enforcement officers wanting this clarification. 10 to 13 from my office in Woodburn signed that. I've got two chief of police from Carlton and Turner that were going to try to be here. They couldn't make it, but they support it. So there is support out there for it. It's not just a couple of cop wannabes. So I'll stop right there and answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Questions, committee? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple questions. First one would be regarding how many people work at, like, the Woodburn station versus a portable station. How many people do you have at Woodburn working there at any given time weighing trucks and checking trucks during the day?
Yes. What we have is a 24-hour shift, 7 hours a day, or 7 days a week. Maximizing the time during the day when the most number of trucks are on the road. Right now, we're at most of set scales, and I run a portable team once a week. And that once a week, I've got 18 sites around there approved throughout my district that we can go set up our signs and do portable operations. I usually take a 6-man team with me because as we're weighing the truck, somebody has to write the tickets. We see out-of-service violations, and we have to inspect the truck. So I'm always pulling people away from the team to do that. So I have 6 people I try to stay with me all the time, so I have enough people to do the job.
I guess.
When we're out doing portable work, it's not as safe as a scale house. We're beside the road. Traffic's there. It helps. The pickup I have has a lot of lights on it. When it's running, being white, the public doesn't know who it is, if it's a policeman or not. They slow down. They don't do that for ODOT crews. So that's why I like the light situation. But when we're doing a portable operation, we're pulling in every truck as we can. We have a flagger that when we're filled, we wave them on by. So we're looking at legal trucks along with the bad trucks. And it's kind of, some days I'll go out and not write one ticket. Understandably, it's a deterrent. If they know we're there, they're going to try to run legal because they don't want to get caught. We would like it to be closer to where we could see the bigger violations and pull them over one at a time.
Let me interrupt you real quick. How many, when you set up your portable scale, how many people are working that site?
7.
As 7 people.
Myself and 6-man crew.
Okay. And then at Woodburn, you have 6 or 7?
We've got 13 people as crew members at the Woodburn crew.
And approximately how many trucks blow by on a daily basis?
When we're out doing portables or at the scale?
At the scale and at the portables.
At portables, we have a flagger out, so we have none. Truck drivers aren't apt to go by you if you're pointing at them and pointing them into a spot. They've been recognized. The scale's different because when you're working with a truck or working with a driver, some drivers out there believe he'll never see me. And so they go by. Back road scales, the bypassers Woodburn District has, are almost none. You get a few on the freeway, but because of the traffic and where our green light system's set up, we can't recognize all of them as they go by.
Now my next question would be, will you need more personnel if you start chasing down the trucks that are going by?
Well, what I'm concerned with isn't as much chasing bypassers as observing a violation that's bad and requiring them to stop. If somebody blows by the scale, you've got, like I said, in our back road scales, we had none.
Right.
So,
but your highway scales, are you going to need more personnel to go when a truck goes by?
I wouldn't, no.
Let me kind of bring some light on that. You know, the majority of our traffic stops that we've done over the years before we were able to, you know, before we lost the ability, was actually working back roads and highways, not on the interstate. The trucks that you're catching that are you know, overweight are the ones that are going from the rock pit to the construction site, knowing that they're not passing a scale, so they're the ones who will overload the truck and try to get there. The bypassers on the freeway, because of our own rules about not exceeding speed limits, et cetera, it's a moot point to try to chase them because they're already doing 55 miles an hour. By the time you lock the scale house or told the guy next to you, I'm going to go after that guy is so far down the road that it would take you miles and miles to catch up with him. So we've got cameras now that we have at a lot of the ports of entry. At our particular port of entry, I work in Ashland, it's pretty successful because the road proximity to the scale house is very close. It's not obstructed. We can see the guys coming across the green light scales before they get to the entry ramp, before they get to us. So it works real well for us. Now, it didn't necessarily work well for everybody. But, you know, this pursuit thing that everybody's kind of locked in on is not really, it's a very, very minute part of what we would even try.
My question is more personnel.
Sure.
You know, handling this.
Yeah, you don't.
Because
you're
looking at going out to different locations now and watching trucks away from them.
We work portable scales with two people in our district. Two people.
That's the way I see most of them. I haven't seen one with six people on a portable.
He's at a busier location than we are, so you know he gets a lot higher volume of trucks, so they have to keep things scooting through where we don't have that issue so much. So we work two people at a portable scale. On a busy day, we have two weighmasters weighing trucks at the port of entry on a busy day. A lot of days, there's only one person there. They're not going to lock up that scale and go chase somebody. It's just not even practical. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
And we're not talking
basically what I was trying to get out. Okay. Because a lot of these portables, I'll stop and I see one guy there or two guys, so I'm thinking, okay, if guys are going by,
right,
is he going to shut everything down
but
and
you're
go?
So close to the road, if that guy is silly enough to go by, you're looking right at him from sometimes me to you watching him go by. You know, so that would be kind of silly. Generally, they'll turn off.
Which, Madam Chair, if I may, this kind of leads into a follow-up I was going to have. That guy who is looking at you and goes by,
mm-hmm.
and now if you do run him down, and this is different for you because you were in law enforcement yourself, but there's probably a reason why he went by. I mean, it could be he's got drugs in the back. He could have a load of illegal aliens. It could be a number of things.
Well, Norm, you're seeing the worst side of everything where the 99.9% of the commercial truck drivers out there are law-abiding citizens. If they go by, there's one, they're not sure what they're doing and didn't know they were supposed to pull in. Two, they're overweight and don't want to pull in. Three, they're oversized and don't want to pull in. Four, they're not running their safety equipment or logbooks or whatever, and they don't want to pull in. Those aren't drug dealers or illegal alien haulers. That's the traffic we see, and we've seen it for decades. A lot of them just, like I said, you got a small percentage that just don't even know. They don't even pay attention. They're in some kind of zone in their head, and they drive right by and wonder who we are.
Talking on cell phones. That's one of the main reasons of bypassing scales is they're talking on cell phones.
I just don't want one of you guys to end up being that 0.1%.
We don't either. Trust me, we don't either. But on the flip side of that, the guy you stop at that outlying scale in the middle of the night, you don't know what his condition is either, and we do that already and have never stopped. So, you know, that's part of that inherent risk that I talked about. We have a certain amount of inherent risk in this job, and I don't think there's anything we can do to eliminate that and do our job. Okay, sir?
Chairman Byers, Representative, I worked in the shipyards in the middle 70s when Oregon actually had shipyards, when they were building the Chevron oil tankers. And in 1 year, they killed 11 people down there. They asphyxiated some. They had cranes run over some. They dropped steel plates on some. In the 30 years that we worked stopping trucks on the roadside, nobody has ever been hurt. Representative Gilman, you who used to own a dairy farm, can tell you that a cranky cow can put you in a hurt a lot worse than a lot of things can. And I found that out here a few weeks ago. I was separating calves to do some surgery on them. And I had a mama cow take exception to it, and she put me into a wall. I mean, it's, you know, there's other occupations that are just as dangerous. I mean, if that was the case, we'd all be living in a rubber room. Loggers, they go through the same stuff. Construction workers, when I was doing curbs and sidewalks and catch basins, we lost three guys on a pipe job in Gresham, and it's because it caved in. It was only 3 feet deep. The guy just happened to be down the wrong spot, got knocked down, and they couldn't get him out. So there's inherent risk with every occupation. But like I said, in 30 years of doing this job, nobody has ever been hurt in the stop.
Representative Boone?
No, I'm going to pass. I pretty much got the answer.
Okay.
Thank you.
No other questions here? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Tim Cannon and Craig Major.
Chair Byer, representatives, thank you for taking time to hear us today. My name is Tim Cannon. I'm a resident of the Dalles, Oregon, beautiful Columbia River Gorge. I'm here today as a concerned citizen and a taxpayer. I've also been employed by the state of Oregon Department of Transportation for the last 22 years, 13 of which have been as motor carrier enforcement officer. I'd like to give a little historical perspective on this, if I might. The citizens of the United States and the state of Oregon are being asked to contribute an unprecedented amount of money on transportation projects. As one who has been out there and seen firsthand the conditions of our roads and bridges, I'm very well aware that they are in serious need of repair, replacement. My concern is that the money that we're being asked to spend is, first of all, spent wisely. We do the best job that we can, the best quality for the money we have to spend, hopefully create some jobs for Oregonians. We all know the unemployment statistics. They don't look good. And next, I would say that I believe like me that we need to then try to make sure that we protect this infrastructure. And historically, there's kind of a little known, at least it was to me, the fact that our previous legislatures saw fit to create an agency that predates actually the state police in this state, which was size and weight enforcement. And these people are the people who are responsible for the protection of that infrastructure. And they were given that specific job by previous legislatures. And In giving them that job, of course, they need to give them the tools to do that job, which was outlined, of course, in ORS 810-530. We really believe that one of the most effective tools is to be able to look at the vehicles and to be able to, rather than pull all the trucks in and create problems for everyone, waste is time is money. It's pretty easy sometimes to see these safety, weight, size violations, be able to target those. Unfortunately, many of the areas in which I work, it's simply not, there's no scales there. It's not possible. I'd like to read a little excerpt from a Secretary of State's audit report. And I think it sums it up fairly well. And this says that the division places a high priority on weighing a large number of inbound trucks at its 6 ports of entry. Another priority is weighing trucks traveling across the state on I-5 and I-84. While this approach helps discourage drivers of illegally overweight trucks from using the interstates, this success comes at a price. The data suggests a gap in the division's enforcement network that affects much of the state highway system. Drivers of illegal overweight trucks face little chance of being caught when using state highways leading out of Oregon, secondary state highways, and state highways in metropolitan areas. After this report came out, there was a temporary change, in how some of the operations were conducted that next year. And the results are this. The MCTD management decided they would, instead of just increasing the time spent on the secondary roads, they would massively increase it. They decreased the overall weighings in the state by 50%. That's a lot of weighings to miss. However, I'd like to point out that the total enforcement only dropped by 18%. That's because that even though only there was another 10,000 more trucks weighed on the secondary roads, the enforcement rate went up by 22%. That supports the Secretary of State's audit findings that the secondary roads are a serious problem. And this is precisely where the ability to stop certain vehicles comes in, is on the secondary roads, because many of these secondary roads have absolutely no scales. So our only method, our only tool on those secondary roads is to be able to stop the vehicles that we see that have potential problems or obvious problems. And in the words of Forrest Gump, that's about all I have to say about that.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the committee members. My name is Craig Major. I'm going to come from this from a perspective of a Portland police officer, actually former Portland police officer. I retired in January this year. Part of my various tasks once I was assigned to the traffic division was motor carrier safety enforcement. I was trained as an officer to enforce the rules in 1993. So I have a 15-year experience working as an enforcement officer with the motor carrier people, and specifically Kermit Mailing behind me and others and his crew. We at times had interagency cooperation and did missions within Portland. And I'm also coming from a perspective that before their authority was taken away, I saw how they worked. And since their stop authority has been taken away, I've seen the result of that. And quite frankly, and as simply as I can put it, there is more violations going on in Portland than you can shake a stick at. There's no need for them to load properly. There's not even a threat of stopping anymore. I was the last officer in Portland trained as an inspector and did weighing. There are none right now. Multnomah County does not have a team. Clackamas County doesn't have a team. They have one fellow that does weighing. He works for the road department. He doesn't have police authority. And there's also one deputy in Washington County that does this. Needless to say, it's not enough. And right now there is no enforcement in Portland. They're ruining the roads. They're ruining the overpasses. they're tearing apart the infrastructure. A case in point that I worked quite a bit in Portland, and you're probably familiar with the project, the Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard Viaduct Overpass project, still going on in completion about another year or so. But the trucks were violating that constantly. I mean, I have stopped scores, if not hundreds of trucks, going over that. And it did very little. I mean, there were still scores more that I didn't stop. There's just more work than we can shake a stick at to get done. If I may just address your issue you had with these folks, sir, as far as the potential of running into a wayward trucker, a criminal. Part of my job also as a police officer was interdiction, and we would actively seek out the smugglers, the hauling of illegal contraband north and south on I-5 specifically. And granted, we did hit it, and we did find them, but we were looking for it. I was trained in certain indicators and what to look for on these trucks and mannerisms of the truck drivers once they've been stopped and what to look for and then seize their illegal contraband, the chances of these folks happen to stop some trucker during the day that's just doing his work and coming across one of these people is slim to none. Truly, it's just slim to none. From my perspective as a former officer, please give these people back their authority to stop these folks that are overweight, oversized, and simply are not going by the rules. And I will say, especially in Portland, there's no enforcement going on right now. Yeah, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. That's all I have. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Questions? I have one more point, Representative Widener. As to your point, yes, I have been threatened with violence by a trucker before in a scale facility, but never during a traffic stop, sir.
Any questions for this panel? Representative Boone.
You mentioned that Portland had no enforcement. If the previous panel said they weren't planning on seeking additional personnel, so I'm just not clear on how this passing this bill would help things in Portland since the motor carriers are state employees.
Well, if I understand your question properly, Kermit Mailing and his crew are in Portland. They just don't have the authority to stop trucks. They see are overweight. And you brought up another good point. There are no scales per se in Portland. We just pick a wide spot in the road and work it. It's not like the rural areas where it's more convenient to put a scale on the side of the road.
Any other questions? Representative Call.
Madam Chair, I would just like to say thank you to all that you guys have testified today. I think you've made a very compelling argument and very thoughtful in your presentation.
Thank you. I have a Craig Campbell and a Kevin Campbell and Bob Russell.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, first of all, my apologies for the fact that there's two Campbells up here today. I mean, you might ask, how many Campbells does it take to testify? And I hope your answer isn't too many today. So.
Kevin, that behavior is unexcusable.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police today. I'm here to express opposition to House Bill 2884. My testimony will be fairly narrowly crafted to address the safety issues. You've already heard testimony indicating that Waymasters don't believe there's a safety issue here, or at least not one that amounts to a significant level. However, on behalf of the Chiefs of Police, who've been in opposition to a similar bill for the last two sessions as well, we do have a concern. The concern really has to do with the fact that as in any pursuit where we're pulling somebody over, there are two extremely dangerous situations you are engaged in. The first one, and law enforcement officers are keenly aware of this, is any time you pull over a vehicle, period, that is one of the most dangerous tasks a law enforcement officer performs. It's simply the process of pulling people over, doing it safely, and handling a stop. That is an unsafe process for law enforcement officers. The second is probably more significant. I think the testimony today has indicated that there is very little chance that you would ever come upon a person who may represent a risk to your safety. However, a Waymaster who pulls over under this bill someone with lights, wearing a uniform, having a badge, without a weapon, approaching a vehicle, does not know at the time that they pull over the vehicle what they are coming upon. And I would agree with conjectures that, by and large, Bob's folks are safe, law-abiding people, but not everybody. And it could be a number of things, not just coming upon someone who is committing a felony, not just somebody who is involved in some kind of drug trade activity, but maybe somebody who's had a very bad day. Maybe somebody who has a weapon, somebody who has some other issue that's going on, that in that stop represents a dangerous situation. And so the chiefs of police, as we looked at this bill, are emphasis on this does have to do with training. In the bill, it does require the Department of Transportation to offer training. The training we believe is necessary, as we've talked about it, is the 16-week academy. You're doing the work of a police officer in this particular situation. And if, as you know, if you've been out to the academy and you've had a chance to tour around there, one of the emphases is on what we call scenario-based training. That is, we want to give officers the ability to see what it's like to come upon a car stop and realize that you're not dealing with somebody that has your best interests at heart. And so if, for those two reasons, those are the two of the most important tasks that law enforcement officers perform in their duties, pulling over people in traffic and coming upon somebody and having to navigate an issue when it gets out of hand that they have to be prepared to handle. I did hear testimony indicating that there was training in the past that deals with how to deal with difficult people, in essence, people that are angry, how to handle that. That's good. I think the need for training goes far beyond that. And I think in the event that someone came upon a situation, however unlikely, where a weapon was involved or some other violence was perpetrated, I wouldn't want to be the waymaster in that situation, and I don't know that it's in the best interest of the state of Oregon to do that. Now, also, a couple of chiefs of police were mentioned having support of this bill. I've talked to both of them, and they do support increased enforcement of these violations. That is their interest. I would suggest there's other ways to accomplish that. And so with that, that's my brief testimony. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time.
Representative Call.
Yeah, Mr. Kevin.
Thank you.
I'll get to you later. I just quickly, what I find very interesting about this bill is that we needn't look at it in the abstract. You've addressed concerns about the adequacy of training and just general concerns about the bill. We have 30 years of data, probably accumulated, 30 years in which the motor carriers were doing exactly what we're talking about trying to let them do here. And so my question to you is simply is, does the Association of Chiefs of Police, have they looked through that data to find examples of exactly what you're concerned about? Because it seems to me we've heard testimony today that would tend to assuage those concerns, such that we have 30 years of enforcement without any serious incidents of injury.
Chair Call and members of the committee,
yes, gave me a pay raise.
I have.
I'm sorry, Vice Chair. Not a pay
raise. Chair
Biden. Yeah, no, sorry.
The answer to your question is yes, that in fact there are examples of problems that actually resulted in firings as a result of the behavior of a motor carrier in situations where I don't have those specific cases with me. However, I would guess ODOT might have them. They might have access to those because I'm sure they were connected to those legally, if not in other ways. So.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. I would like to just for the record, I would like to see that. And
yes.
And you know, people do get terminated from their jobs quite often throughout many state agencies. So I'm sure it's not an uncommon occurrence. And so I would like to see for what reason those terminations occurred and whether safety was at issue. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Well.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I'm testifying in between two Campbells today.
We didn't want to submit them to both of us at once. That would be unfair.
Which is a very unusual position to be in. As you've heard me say many, many times, safety is the number one priority to our organization, and that's what brings us here today in opposition to this proposal. You know, one of the things that Representative Call points out is that at one point the Waymasters used to have the authority to chase. And I would suggest to you that, you know, the world has sort of changed over those years in a whole bunch of different ways. If you'll notice from the notebook that you had one AG's opinion that said that they did have the authority to pursue, and you had another one a few years later that said they didn't. And basically, in our society as we become sort of more litigious and more concerned about liabilities and all of those kinds of things, we've become more conservative in those ways. That is a significant change. And I respect the department for protecting the state of Oregon from lawsuits and those kinds of things by terminating behavior that could lead to significant lawsuits and judgments. The other thing that's really changed a lot is the volume of traffic on our roads. A long time ago, there weren't very many trucks and there weren't very many cars. Today, there is significant congestion throughout the state, which makes pursuing vehicles all the more dangerous. I mean, it's really a different world out there. And I think that the department has recognized that when they made the decision to forbid Waymasters from chasing trucks. I also have provided you with a resolution from the Motor Carrier Transportation Advisory Committee. The Motor Carrier Transportation Advisory Committee has been in place since 1995. It works with the Department of Transportation in providing advice on motor carrier issues. We meet once a month. They are very dynamic meetings, as you might imagine. This particular resolution was adopted on Thursday, and it also opposes this measure, and it provides a number of reasons why, primarily because of safety. You know, from our perspective also in this very difficult economic times, it seems to me that it doesn't make sense to spend a lot of money because BPST 16-week training and chase vehicles and all those kinds of things are very expensive to train somebody to be a police officer so they can weigh trucks. I think, you know, from our perspective, what we really should be doing is we should be spending money to train new troopers to work for OSP, to fight crime and make our highways safer. That's a better, in our view, expenditure of monies. And I will conclude my testimony and be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, gentlemen. You're in the hot seat. I'm hearing your safety concerns, but there is another issue that I haven't heard you address, and you touched on it, Mr. Campbell. And that is, what do we do about trucks that, sure, in violation of the law, go blowing by, and then your folks, sure, are left paying fines, and they're getting by? So if this is not the answer, either they're not blowing by, or there should be other ways that we can get at this, and I'd like to hear your suggestions.
Now, Madam Chair, Representative Berger, to sort of put this in context, the Federal Highway Administration has standards for state size and weight programs, and they actually conduct audits of the states to make sure that the size and weight programs comply with those standards. The Department of Transportation has been audited, and their size and weight program meets and exceeds the standards. So that's one point. We have a very effective size and weight program. Secondly, when you compare the number of personnel that we have employed in size and weight enforcement in Oregon compared to some of the surrounding states on a per truck basis, we have a large number of motor carrier enforcement personnel per truck. So you've got a lot of folks out there. Third point is, in the last couple of years, ODOT has developed a new process which is working wonderfully, and it's called photo bypass. Much like photo red light, they actually have installed cameras at all of the ports of entry and at two of the way stations, where they take pictures of the driver and in the front of the vehicle, noting the license plate, and then they mail them a ticket. And it's reduced the level of bypass, which was already very low. It was 0.5% is what you have in this resolution. It's virtually eliminated it at all of the locations where these cameras have been installed. So there is a technological, or has been a technological fix to deal with the bypass issue that doesn't compromise anybody's safety.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Russell, thank you for testifying today. I have a few, just a couple of things. I think that there is agreement amongst you and the panels from before that the bypass concern has, for all intents and purposes, been addressed by the by the technology you just talked about. And in fact, that if you got somebody blowing by who's speeding, they wouldn't pursue anyway because they wouldn't have the capacity to catch up to them. So glad to see that there's some agreement here today about that. My question, though, to follow up on Representative Berger's question, is how we make sure that the roads are safe and that people are driving legally who are actively avoiding the stations.
Madam Chair, Representative Call. Whoa.
Sorry.
It's Friday afternoon.
It's Friday, yeah.
Representative Call, you know, there's a number of things. I mean, you've got two parts. You talked about safety, truck safety, and operating on the highways, and I would suggest to you that, in large part, that is a function of law enforcement. Law enforcement, OSP, pulls over hundreds and thousands of trucks every year, does safety inspections to make sure that we are operating safely, checks the drivers, and does all of that kind of stuff. So you do have a law enforcement function involved in truck safety that I think is being very effectively exercised by law enforcement in a safe way. The other issue is the size and weight. And not only do we have the ports of entry, but we have secondary scales located all over the state where the waymasters go and staff those on a sporadic basis so that nobody is anticipating that they will be there, when they will be open, when they will be closed. Then you've also heard today a third approach, which is the portable scales. And you can use the portable scales in a parking lot, in a wide part of the road, in a chain-up area, those kinds of things where you can safely pull vehicles over and weigh them using portable scales. And nobody knows when that's going to happen because there's no fixed location. They are, you know, they're roving and around the state, and as long as it's in a safe place, they're using the portables. So I think that there is a very effective method of size and weight enforcement, and going back again to the Federal Highway Administration, they also agree with that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you say that all the second two are effective means of enforcement within the Portland area, given the testimony by the former Portland police officer in this regard, that quite possibly this method of enforcement is the only method of enforcement that could get at some of the amount that you can shake a stick at?
Madam Chair, Representative Call, as you know, I used to work for the state of Oregon, and we did joint exercises, our safety folks, with the Waymasters. We did them in the Portland area, and what we used are parking lots and things like that, and we would have, as they described earlier, you flag the vehicle end in the parking lot, they would weigh them and do the inspection. So I think that there are a number of locations in the Portland area where that can be done, and I would suggest to you that it's far safer to do that than it is to pull a vehicle over on the side of the road, particularly with the congestion in the Portland area. One of the things about Portland is that this Portland Police Department used to have a truck unit, and they focused on trucks. They did portable wangs. They did all that kind of stuff. So we have lost some personnel in the Portland area. I don't think it's an issue of authority to do certain things. I think it's a staffing issue.
And just one final thing on an unrelated topic. In my research into this bill and its past incarnations and in different ways it's come up, something constantly came up, which is that it seemed that there was a pilot program agreed to last year, and that my understanding is that a lot of the stakeholders who were involved were supportive of it. And I'm wondering if during last session you were supportive of a pilot program, and as well if you can elucidate what happened to it since it didn't come into effect.
Madam Chair, Representative Call, I don't remember the bill number from last session, but that started out as one thing and was narrowed down to a pilot. That bill ended up on the table in the House, on the House floor at the end of session, and it did not pass.
Thank you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I can drag this on so we don't have to hear from the other Campbell. But
we have three other people after him, so we wouldn't have
to. The question I have is, I listened to this, and for just a little insight, I guess, my brother is a truck driver, so he does drive for FSA. And he has been pulled over by the state police and given tickets a couple times. So for little minute issues. So the state police are doing some of this actively. But as I listen to this in the safety and after hearing about him getting attacked in the truck stops or having issues there, which everybody gets upset once you're told you're going to get a ticket, it usually ruins your day at that point. I'm wondering if we shouldn't be looking at more a situation where the state police should be at the weigh station with some of the weigh masters, or if this shouldn't be something that's handled by the state police in certain cases.
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, when I was with the state, the PUC had staff at all of the ports of entry, and we also had arrangements with the state police so that they would respond very quickly if there was an incident at a weigh station. And they were very, very rare. But when they did happen, OSP was wonderful and came very quickly. Certainly, we are all aware that the staffing levels at OSP went down, and we started bringing them back up. And from our perspective, we would encourage the legislature to provide adequate funding to OSP. We think it's a very essential service for everyone in the state, and we would do whatever we can to make sure that that happens.
Thank you. Representative Schaffner.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. We've just hit on what we need to do right there. Even Representative Barker's letter says, if there's a state trooper unavailable, that's the problem. Right. I mean, they work in unison very well together, right. And that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm a firm believer if you want to pull rigs over, you should be a state police officer. Other states, the state police literally does this. And I'm not suggesting there's not a problem. I'm not suggesting there's not a need. I'm not suggesting that these folks aren't doing a good job. But we just hit on the solution right there. More state police officers out there working with these good people and getting right down to the solution to this problem.
Thank you. Go ahead. We're gonna.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell, the other Campbell. I'm here very briefly on behalf of one client and somewhat less briefly on another. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Associated Loggers, and what I'm going to merely do is put on the record that they're in opposition to the bill because there are other members of the Natural Resources Commodity Carriers that are in the room that will be providing testimony, and it would be very similar to that. I'm also here on behalf of AAA, and our perspective is a little different. It has been consistently in opposition of this proposal in the past, but not in the way that it has been discussed previous to now. Our concern is when a pursuit, whether high-speed or not, occurs in the course of traffic, because then you're dealing with automobiles as well, especially when there is congestion or there's a good amount of traffic where you're trying to catch up with a truck that, even if it's going the speed limit, is going to take a while to catch up with. When you have a law enforcement officer who's been trained to deal with traffic, has been in traffic, most of what they do is in traffic, then we have a confidence that person knows what to do in those circumstances. Our position has been pretty consistent. If you want to increase the responsibilities of motor carriers so that they can pursue them, what you need to do is provide adequate training so that they can do so effectively. And in our opinion, that happens to be through the current program at DPSST, in specific with their road training, which is a hands-on program. The difficulty with train the trainers is it is not a hands-on program. You don't have somebody getting in a car, going through the experiences that they might find on the road. So our concern is for the protection of the motoring public when somebody is trying to enforce the law on a truck. With that, unless there are any questions, I'm happy to conclude my testimony.
Thank you. Representative,
I had just a thought. Somebody asked the bill number, and it came to me. It's either 3273 or 3271 from 2007, possibly.
73. Okay. I just have a quick question. Given that, you know, we keep talking about having more police on the road, What kind of training are police given in the loading, you know, the overweight loads, to spot them? I mean, so I don't know if that's clear enough. But.
Madam Chair, Representative, I would hate to draw him up, but I think Eric Skablix from DPSST is here. He may not have the answer, but he might. Is he frowning at me right now?
Through the back of my head. Oh, he's smiling. Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Eric Gablix, Deputy Director for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. In the basic training program for law enforcement officers, you have to keep in mind we're training new officers that have never been police officers. In the 16 weeks, we focus on the essential survival skills and the service skills that they need. We do not provide motor carrier enforcement type training in that 16-week class. Those classes are done through our regional training program, usually in partnership with the motor carrier enforcement programs that you heard the earlier testimony from the Trucking Association. So there have been officers, deputies, troopers, and trained, and you've probably read news releases where they've done trucker checks, looking for drug use, those type of things. So those training programs are usually done in partnership with ODOT, other providers that come in, usually on grant programs, I believe, and they provide specialized training to people that are going to be assigned to go out and look for those, usually on the interstate highways.
Quickly, a follow-up is that mandatory training for these people, for the troopers that...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I cannot say that it's mandatory. I believe that if they're going to be getting grants that are going to go for enforcement of those type of things, I believe they have to have the training to go out and do those. But I can't say that it's mandatory that all the officers in the department get that. I can say that as a follow-up for the Oregon State Police, once they leave our basic training program for the new troopers after 16 weeks, they do get additional training for the Oregon State Police-related issues, which are somewhat different than city-county enforcement. I believe they get into a lot more vehicle-related incidents because they're mostly on the highways.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, too. And Tammy Denny and Don Miner. I'm looking at this, and it looks like Dan Miner. And I'm thinking that's not the right person.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner, here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association, to speak in opposition to this bill. We expect those folks transporting our very large houses down the roads to obey all the laws. Madam Chair, you may remember last session we came before you asking for increased penalties for manufactured home transporters and other truckers who disobeyed the law. It appeared that it was sometimes cheaper to disobey the law and pay a fine than to comply with the requirements. So, for example, there were transporters who wouldn't have the proper number of pilot vehicles, or they would take shortcuts where sometimes they run into bridges, by the way. And this committee did increase the penalties. Our concern is that it doesn't, we're fearful of chasing down a manufactured home that happens to go by a weigh station, pulling them this 14-foot or wider load to the side of the road and standing there and writing a ticket. It's not only going to be hazardous to the enforcement personnel, the motoring public, but to our drivers as well. We think a better solution is the cameras that are being used now, that they take a picture, mail them a ticket. And if the tickets are not sufficiently high that people would rather just pay the ticket than obey, then increase the penalty, as we've done before. We don't think it occurs all that often, but our understanding is that the photo enforcement is working very, very well. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dan, I was just wanted to... you're stating for the record that you think increased fines would probably work better?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Widener, if that's necessary. It's
I don't know that there is a problem. We have not heard back that there is a problem that's not manageable by the existing system. But if that were necessary, we would support it. Again, we expect them to obey the law.
Yes. Okay. Tammy, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tammy Denny. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Wheat Growers League. The league is a statewide trade association located in Umatilla County. However, we do represent every producer, about 4,000 wheat producers and landowners across the state, responsible for about 1 million acres of production. So, of course, we're engaged in transportation issues, and transportation is vitally important to moving those commodities from farm gate to the first point of sale. I appear before you today to oppose House Bill 2884, and there are a variety of reasons. We want to be certain that we state for the committee today that we are in no way have we ever in the past or today speak in favor of our producers disobeying the law as far as going past a weigh station, dishonoring a weigh master and their orders, or being weighed appropriately and paying their weight mile tax. Our growers have been educated. We've worked very closely with the Department of Transportation to engage our producers in educational programming so that they understand what the expectations are so that they can comply. We're very proud of the fact that we've worked very closely with the Department of Transportation on the Freight Advisory Committee and other transportation advisory committees to work towards solutions as opposed to trying to only throw rocks from the sidelines. We want to be part of the solution. We've asked for a seat at the table, and we've been given a seat at the table, and we show up. We believe that there are a number of reasons that this bill, House Bill 2884, is not worthy of moving from this committee, and those reasons include safety for both the waymasters and those they stop, the liability to the state, and we also believe that this function is currently being serviced through an agreement that exists between OSP and ODOT. You might be interested to note, you've heard some testimony already this afternoon, that there was a previous bill. Representative Boone was very clever in identifying and remembering the bill number from the last session. Since the last session, you might also be curious to know that there are members and employees within ODOT who believed that bill passed. And when individuals who have been faced with enforcement from Waymasters called the Salem office and asked for clarification as to the authority, they were told that bill had passed and that, in fact, was the law of the land. As you know, that's not the case, and that's why we're here again today to talk about basically the same matter. We think that the reintroduction and the continued conversation just adds to the confusion. In fact, we have situations that have occurred last summer east of the Cascades with growers, with log truck operators being engaged by waymasters, stopped alongside of the road and pursued with their lights on to pull folks over alongside of the road as opposed to allowing them to get to the next fixed station and then enforcing upon them. But it was the issue of pursuit that raised the question. In your packet that I provided you, there is a letter that was written by one of the log truck operators who was cited, and he indicates that when he asked the waymaster whether or not the waymaster had authority to pursue and whether or not that authority was in place, the waymaster would not answer him. So I think that the continued discussion and the continued confusion does not serve anyone well. It certainly doesn't serve the issues that exist within ODOT between management and the union, and it certainly doesn't serve the public who are the ones who are on the receiving end of the enforcement at whatever level. We, the Oregon Wheat Growers League, do not oppose enforcement of the state's laws or the regulations. However, we do take issue with inconsistent enforcement and when we have individuals operating outside of their authority. We really think that this issue raises the question of financial liability as far as the safety, again, of the waymasters, the safety of the public, but also the training that would be necessary. in this these previous few days, I've been engaging members of the committee to discuss this bill and to help you understand why it was that the Oregon Wheat Growers League would care about this bill. And as through those conversations, I was asked to offer up some additional statistics, information that I didn't myself possess because I don't purport myself to be an ODOT expert. That information was then sought out through a public records request. It has been attached to your testimony, and I won't belabor the points for you, but statistics do show, and the statistics have been provided to you, that increased enforcement certainly is not warranted. And with that, I'll close my remarks, and thank you very much for allowing us to speak to this bill.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. First of all, I would hope that we have the director vote out here that just to go back, I would make a request just to go back and contact every single waymaster and inform them and make it very clear and make up a process to make sure they know this, that the pursuit is not within the law. And that there is nothing saying that there's nothing they can do legally if someone ignores them on the highway, because you don't have to pull over for them because they don't have the enforcement ability to do that if they're being pursued by a waymaster. And I really hope you clarify that with all the good employees. More importantly, too, this is not a labor management issue. This is a policy decision. If there's labor management issues, that's a separate conversation. I just wanted to clarify that. This, for me, is not a labor management issue. This is a policy decision. And I just want to get that on the record very clearly. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Cole.
And one thing I would like to point out, when Director Garrett does that research, is this letter could very well be construing facts for a portable weigh station, and it might very well be that the confusion that exists here is between pursuit authority and the way portable weigh stations are manned. And we've already heard testimony even from the Truckers Association of the importance of those portable weigh stations. And if the confusion is between those two separate procedures, maybe the most logical way forward is to actually give pursuit authority so that there is no confusion between a portable weigh station and between pursuit authority. So I think that there's more ways to skin a cat on this thing than simply to say that this person was simply pursued unlawfully and that the facts could prove out differently. And I'll give you a copy of this letter. I have it here. And then I just briefly have just one. You know, I'm good, actually. I've made my point. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Just to kind of echo and follow up on what Representative Schaffler was saying, since we do have the director here, I think one of the big things facing his management is a safety issue. And the last thing we want is a car accident because we pull over a manufactured home on the side of the road where it's too narrow. And the last thing I would want is one of my employees getting shot or beat to death from running down the wrong rig. So these are issues that need to be addressed and that we need to look at seriously as a committee when we're making these decisions. And I think this is something that we need to make sure we make the right decision here, because I don't want this on my conscience that I voted the wrong way. So,
thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, we have a wrap-up by Director Garrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Matthew Garrett, the Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. I heard you, Representative Schaffner. We will make sure there is a clarity, but that's part of the issue here. There's more ambiguity than clarity. I will tell you, I'm extremely proud of my leadership team over at the Motor Carrier Transportation Division. I have great respect and for the commitment and the dedication of my motor carrier enforcement officers. I do. We've seen business partners come forward, argue for and against. It's a troubling time. We need clarity in this conversation. That is the bottom line. So should this committee, and I concur with Representative Schaffler, this is a policy discussion, and should this committee move in a new direction with regard to pursuit policy, my hope is we do bring a clarity to the authorities. That's what I asked for. As Representative Widener suggested, safety is my concern. I want to make sure my folks are trained. I want no one hurt. I want no one hurt on my staff, I don't want the traveling public in any way compromised as well. So training is significant. And if you read this bill, indeed, my agency is directed to train and educate motor carrier officers to how to truly address in a safe and efficient manner how one detains and reacts after a vehicle has been detained. I find comfort in that.
Thank you.
I would ask that all aspects of this training be engaged by the professionals at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. They are the experts. Show me what is needed. I want my people safe. They're the pros. Let's go there. With these type disciplines in place, I'm more than happy to commit to seeking a viable solution, perhaps a pilot program, to better inform this discussion. Because the bottom line is I want to keep Oregonians safe, whether they wear an ODOT jersey or they're just the traveling public at whole. So that's where I stand. I look forward to this discussion, and I look forward to bringing clarity to an issue that's come before this panel, I know, three legislative sessions in a row. We need to come to some closure on this.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Matt, thank you.
Yes, sir.
And I will do everything I can to help you come up with that so we can close this and put it to bed and make it easier for you and your decisions that you have to make.
Representative Call.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Director Garrett. I would just like to say, first of all, for the record, that you have been thoughtful and courteous in your discussions with me on this, and that I do feel like we've been able to engage in a very proactive manner, and for that I'm very appreciative. I guess, first of all, I think that everybody would like to put this matter to rest. There are people who've been dealing with this thing for a lot longer than me, and it seems to me that one of the ways we could have been a heck of a lot closer to putting this thing to the rest was to get the pilot program done last session that was agreed to. Can you explain to me what happened to that and how we can actually get that done this session so that next session we come back we can have hard facts about how this thing works and whether or not it's a good idea, so that we're not dealing on conjecture or evidence that's, for me, 30 years of history up until 4 years ago is pretty good, but for others it's not. And so I would, at the very least, I feel like we can get fresh statistics, fresh evidence out there, and that we would have had that this session. So can you elucidate what happened and maybe help me figure out how we can get past the problems that occurred?
Madam Chair, Representative Call, I can tell you what I know. We had a vehicle. We had the bill, 3273, working through it. I had conversations then with co-chair Mary Nolan, which articulated a pathway for a pilot project that engaged in discussion at a Ways and Means subcommittee panel, and it laid on the table. Nothing came forth from that. So the vehicle I knew of went away. Now, I have heard of conversations, agreements between folks. My department was not involved in those conversations. My conversations were with the legislature. You are my policy directors for all intents and purposes. I execute and implement what you give me. That's my knowledge. That's where I took it. I knew there were other conversations, but I wasn't engaged in those.
And just for the record, Director Garrett and I have had discussions, and one of the things I've talked about is that the fiscal on the pilot project that came out last year was to my estimation very high. I don't know if we agree on that, but there was some concern that it was unnecessarily high, and so we've been working to work towards trying to figure out how to bring the cost down and. Kermit Melling and the folks that came in here today, I think, have pointed to some of that there is existing training, there's existing cars, there's existing light packages out there, and that if we dug deep and actually really took a hard look at the fiscal on this thing, we might be able to drive down the price on it. So I hope that we do that moving forward. And then I just ask lastly, actually, we've been here long enough. I'm done. We're good. I've put you all through enough today, and thank you for indulging me in that, except for the three who've left.
Thank you. Mr. Garrett, I guess given the conversation we just had about the confusion out there over the enforcement authority and how to clarify this, a pilot program, does, in your mind, can that help to clarify it or hurt in the clarification?
I think it better informs it, to be very honest with you. Again, there are competing authoritative documents, whether you refer back to 1988 in a Department of Justice memo to us, which was countered by a 2004 memo, which said they didn't look at broad enough statute. They were solely focused in one area. Because there is confusion, I think we need to write a new chapter, to be very honest with you. I have too many business partners coming at each other. That's not healthy. We need to address this one way or the other. I think a pilot can inform it. I'm committed to that if we have the right disciplines in place. And again, getting back to safety, let's make sure we train these folks if we move in this direction. I think that doesn't inform, that does inform the situation.
Madam Chair, even those in opposition have said they need to be, people need to be trained to do this job. So I don't know what the pilot exactly would do, if it would be a pilot of folks going through a 16-week training just like a state police officer. I think it'd be fine. Now, clearly that is going to have a substantial fiscal. And every single bill I've ever had where there was a fiscal attached, almost every time I say, It's too high. it's just a disease among legislators. But I believe it will have a fine. And now, if we go through that, down that road, I have no problem with that. But on the other hand, there's also the question, are we going to train pursuit, pulling people over? Are we going to train with firearms? I'd be quite frank with you. I think it may not. If some scofflaw is screaming down the road in some big rig trying to avoid detection, yeah, you know, right then they've already stepped over a certain line, and I don't know. I'd prefer to be armed. I would never do this work, by the way. I'm just too much of a chicken. But I'd prefer to be armed if I were doing that work. And that leads me to the next decision or thought: why not just make every one of them a state police officer, and with a Waymaster, just like we do Fish and Wildlife. We're Representative Krieger. If he were out on the road, he had a wide latitude of dealing with people, but he was a narrow mission out there. So there's a lot to talk about here, Madam Chair. So I don't know if I helped any.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We appreciate it.
You bet.
All right. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2884 and the committee, and have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.